I probably should have eaten. My stomach's like, what's happening to Tara?
I don't know. I just heard, ow.
Ow!
I dropped the lid of my Excedrin bottle under the desk, and it flew really far, and then I had to crawl under to retrieve it, and there's a crossbar under my desk, which I had to put my boobs over, and then when I got back up, I hit my head on the underside of my desk.
Oh, jeez.
So it was a real slapstick experience.
Pre-show done.
Yeah, I'm just making conversation. Just trying to... Sorry.
Have you ever killed anyone?
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 497 for the week of February 5th, 2024. I am tomato fingerer David T. Cole, and I'm here with cake drop Sarah D. Bunting.
Boom.
Damn, Tara Arrieta.
This will give me the quick energy I need for a black box play.
And tragically unfinished bagel, Sarah Baker.
You can chew while you do your spy shit.
It's true. Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, she is an actor you have heard with us many times before. Welcome back, Sarah Baker.
Sarah.
Other Sarah.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited. When I heard the theme music, I was like, oh, I'm on the show.
Until then, she didn't know why she was here.
No idea.
Well, she is here to talk about Prime Video's version of Mr. and Mrs. Smith, in which a man, Donald Glover, and a woman, Maya Erskine, get recruited by a mysterious intelligence agency, renamed John and Jane Smith, and moved into a stunning Manhattan brownstone. They are posing as spouses to give them cover as they undertake missions around town and around the world, but can it possibly be very long before these two smart, sexy cuties transition into being a couple for real? And if slash when they do, how much can they trust their own feelings or each other's? The show is inspired by the 2005 film, infamously starring Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. It was co-created by Donald Glover and Francesca Sloan, who formerly worked together on Atlanta. All eight episodes dropped on Prime Video on Friday. We will try not to spoil events from later in the season, but, you know, be aware. Let's do the Chen check-in. Sarah Baker, should our listeners watch Mr. and Mrs. Smith?
I think so, yes.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Absolutely.
Dave.
It's a yes for me.
For me as well. And as I said in my review, which we'll link in the show notes, it's better than the movie. And I stand by that, having rewatched the movie last week. So let's get into it. A key aspect of movies and TV shows about spies is that we're often watching the actors playing the spies as they perform performance. Basically, we're watching them acting. Sarah Baker, as an actor, are you particularly attuned to those moments? What is it like for you to watch them? And if you've done it, what is it like to act them?
You would think I would have noticed that, but I had never thought about it. That's really true. And there are definitely times when you're acting, not so specifically playing like a character like they are, but where you're like, well, am I supposed to be playing this like straightforwardly, or is she pretending to be happy, but she's really upset, that type of thing? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very layered, I guess. They're both so fantastic that I mean, think they do a good job of it.
Yeah, it sounds like they lost themselves in their roles for you.
You have to be thinking of, yeah, what you, the actor, are portraying as the character to the people in the scene, but also being vulnerable enough to let the audience know what your character is feeling. Does mm-hmm. that make sense?
Or yeah, did absolutely. I just get... No.
Yeah.
This is what I want to know.
Yeah. And it's hard to find the balance. And actually, I think that can be where the director comes in to let you know, like, you're in this room full of wealthy people and we're seeing too much that you're not confident to be there or something, right. You know? Mm-hmm. But I think they both, especially, I've only watched the first two episodes, and mm-hmm. so, you know, they're kind of new, so they're not really polished. I mean, they're amazing, and they come up with good spy stuff to do, mm-hmm. which blows my mind, but they're also still just figuring it out, too, and they don't always know what's going on or what they should be doing, and I think that comes through.
This was, I think, as close as a show could be to, like, what if Atlanta but spies because of all the talent involved. So I'll throw this open to the group because that was a show we all really loved. Did you feel those vibes carrying over from that show to here? Sarah Bunting, you go first.
Yeah. And some of that is, you know, the presence of Donald Glover on screen. Mm-hmm. But some of it is that same vibe that show had, which was that these were all attractive, compelling people who didn't have that, like, poreless quality that I'm always complaining about on so much of American TV. And again, American TV has really improved in this regard in the last 10 or 15 years. But that feeling that, like, these are interesting, compelling, foxy people who don't look like they came off a factory line so much, that mm-hmm. that vibe is shared with Atlanta, I feel. They also share an ability in the writing to find clever ways to deliver information that you need that feels, what's that word for when music is playing in a scene and not over a scene? Diegetic? Mm-hmm. Let's try that. Thank you. There's that quality. Also, there are differences, but when you're sort of being dropped into this world that you might not necessarily be familiar with, I would rather have nobody almost besides Donald Glover sort of taking me by the hand, because it's not going to be this, like, awkward cube poo of exposition. He's going to find a way to make it cool and make you feel smart for figuring some shit out by yourself. Mm-hmm. That would be my similarities that I see off the top of my head, which... Mm-hmm. I might be full of shit, but that's what I see.
Well, Dave, you nodded. What are your thoughts on
that? I was just nodding because I'm still kind of sick and I'm feeling a little diegetic still.
You should take one of those new anti-diegetics they have. Mm-hmm.
I've been popping them all day and all I've been doing is shitting my ass off. I don't think it's the right pills.
Yeah, I agree with Sarah, like, and she put it in a way that I hadn't thought about, but there is something about the tone of this show in Atlanta that feels unforced or something. Yeah. Like, they're not, like, creating dynamic TV for you to watch. They're creating a world and you get to, like, enter into parts of it, mm-hmm. which I love.
Yeah. Yeah,
totally.
Absolutely. The first big change the show makes from the movie is to the nature of the titular couple's relationship, which I talked about in the intro. To me, this is proof that the people making it understand a TV show is a TV show and not a movie tilled in 8 chapters or whatever bullshit people say who are embarrassed to be working in television for old-fashioned reasons. And I appreciated that. Sarah Baker, you just gave me the on the nose. Speak on that.
Well, yeah, I think you're exactly right with why they want to make everything a movie. But I think that's one of my favorite parts about the show. Like, I don't watch shows like this, really. Mm-hmm. I watch so much comedy, and then I occasionally tip my toes into a drama. But I don't know that are there a lot of spy shows, or just do I not watch any spy shows? I guess I haven't. Like, I never watched The Americans or some of the big ones, but I love this one. Reminded me of Poker Face in a way. Like, mm-hmm. there's, like, this overarching story, but then there's also, like, a mission of the week that right. you can, so you feel like something ends that you can wrap your head around while you're figuring out, like, okay, who are these people really? And, like, where did they come from? Why are they doing this? Because we're just getting, like, snippets of all that.
Yeah. And also, you know, just to reinforce the Poker Face comparison, this show is very big on having one big guest star per episode. And I thought after watching the first two, the hook of the show was going to be, and we kill them, but it didn't quite go that way, which, you know, would have been kind of fun in its own way. But they kill enough of them anyways. But mm-hmm. yeah, it was great to see all the people pass through, including somebody from Poker Face.
Indeed.
Who is large in Poker Face. So mm-hmm. good comparison mm-hmm. for sure.
Sarah D. Bunting, you also didn't watch The Americans, but I feel like you have more of a grounding in spy shows. You watched Alias and 24 for a time, I think. What were your feelings about that aspect, the episodic nature of this version?
I think that for a spy show to succeed, at least for me, first of all, it has to be good at communicating the tradecraft and telling you something that you don't already know, having watched Alias and The Americans, et cetera, and so on. Mm-hmm. But I think you also have to have like, it doesn't have to be funny or comedic, but there has to be a little bit of wit attached to it. And that the tone of that, especially for episodic TV, I think, and for, I don't know, wanting to make these characters relatable and spend more time with them, like episode to episode versus it being an 8-hour movie, whatever. Somewhere Alan Sepinwall's skin is just literally crawling right now. Sorry, buddy. But I think that they're good at that part of it where it's like, well, these are, you know, even though they're trained and selected, these are still just people dealing with other people whose movements they can't predict. Yeah. And shit can go sideways at any time. And here's how they're going to adapt to that. And that sort of gets you, that like commits you to them.
Right.
Right. There's a challenge when you're doing spy stuff is that if you want it to be real and true, you know, you got the consultant and he's like, well, in fact, they would be spending 4 days in a car on listening to radios and get nothing out of it. But what Sarah's talking about, where it's like, okay, they're spies, but they live in a fallen world. So how does that, you know, translate into show? There's a great scene in the second episode that takes place in Switzerland, mostly. Third episode. You know, they're spies and they're supposed to be blending in. Donald Glover makes chit-chat with the table next to them while they're at breakfast, this old couple. And then later on, they bump into the old couple while they're chasing a suspect. And then there's this whole conversation they, like, can't politely get out of. Even though they're spies, they should have just left to chase them.
Yeah.
You're, like, trying to get out of it in a nice way. So then, and then eventually it's like, I'm going to fucking kill you if you don't move. That was, like, the perfect Hollywood solution to showing what I imagine sometimes is the banality of tradecraft, where you are still living in the real world, but you don't want to show them doing a stakeout for 2 days.
Right.
You figure out a way to make it light and funny and insert this into that. Mm-hmm. So I just feel like if you're going to do a spy show on TV, you do have to insert elements of that. And we think of The Americans as a serious drama, but it did the same thing a lot of the times. It wasn't quite as heightened. You know, it wasn't quite as hybrid of a show as this is, but it definitely pushed a lot of the same buttons.
Yeah, it was a lot of like the tension comes from, I'm in this impossible situation. How am I going to be written out of it? / how am I going to get myself out of it? So, yeah. There is a lot of that. Plus, every episode gets, you know, is a title, like a different point in a relationship, different milestone. So it's like double date, second date, couples therapy, you know, stuff like that. So it's like that's part of it, too, where like they're learning how to be spies and they're learning how to be in this relationship at the same time.
I also like that after they did Atlanta, which I assume mostly filmed in Atlanta, that they decided that if Amazon was going to buy a TV show, it was going to be the most expensive TV show that they could come up with a concept with. It was like the even more expensive version of the Whiskey Cavalier. Remember that show where we're like, how is this happening on a network budget? Because they were like going to a different European city, although maybe it was all Prague and I just couldn't tell the difference. But I was like, oh yeah, good for you. Because like, it was so, so beautiful. The show,
it's
all the locations they go to. And they did such a great job spending Amazon's money.
Even episode one that I was like, oh, I mean, you wouldn't believe the boring tradecraft teru shit I engaged in, like blowing up the little house number at the cake drop and being like, I think that says Beverly, but it's still too pixelated. And then in the next scene, they like round a corner that I've been at a million times. And I was like, yep, Ditmas.
Yeah, I was. I said when we were watching it, I bet that's just Ditmas Park. So I'm glad I was right.
Mm-hmm. Only porches like that in the city.
As you also said at the time, Tara, it makes such a difference when they shoot in the city rather than trying to pass off city X, Y, or Z as New York, because there is something very unique about New York, everything that you just cannot reproduce anywhere. Like the architecture of the brownstones doesn't really exist anywhere else. You know, the vegetation, the quality of light, you can always tell when it's LA, that one place out in Santa Clarita trying to be New York. Because the light is just not New York City light.
Yes.
And they spent, again, way to spend Amazon money, guy.
100%. So the other place where the show deviates from the movie in a major, very visible way is with race-conscious casting, which leads to interesting moments through the season. In the second episode, which Sarah Baker was mentioning earlier, that John and Jane are supposed to infiltrate a fancy auction as patrons. And at the last second, John decides, I'm going to go in as a waiter because I'm going to be one of five black guys in there and I'm going to be too conspicuous. And it's like, this is so smart and like something that never comes up in the movie because you know, the movie is dumb. I was really down on the movie after I watched it again. It's like very bad. So, Sarah Baker, you previously came on to pitch a Pen 15 episode. How did Maya Erskine work for you in this role and in this relationship?
I mean, I love her. It definitely is weird. You're like, oh, she's playing an adult so well. And you're like, no, she is an adult. I have not seen the movie, but my picture in my head for what this would be was a little different. I think I thought it was going to be more like fun and funny and sexy. And it's so much better than that. Mm-hmm. But I was in the first episode, I think a little bit like, oh my God, it's like having these two quarterbacks of comedy and you're not really using them. So I was really happy in the second episode. Like, there was a moment where, well, the barfing, almost barfing, sorry, Sarah, moment.
They didn't. I was fine.
But that moment was really funny. And then even just like there was like Maya was like kind of trying to relax and like in the mirror just makes like a crazy like face gesture that felt very Pen 15 Maya and probably Maya Erskine, how she is, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was glad to see them pull more of that out, even though I do think there's something about people who do comedy, not always, but generally, and definitely these two can improvise. And even when it's not being used for like jokes or comedy, there is a looseness that I think two actors like that can bring that a lot of people wouldn't be able to bring, that like real intimacy and like casual in a good way, like that real feeling.
Yeah. And I think that's the first episode, at least, was directed by Hiro Murai, who directed a bunch of Atlanta, too. And at least the Beef pilot, if not more of it, I think more episodes of that as well. And definitely when the episode ended and his credit came up, I was like, oh, I knew it. Like, you can tell he has that sort of that very light touch and does make it feel very natural. Like you said, like we're not watching a show. We're like peeking in on people's lives as they're being lived. Patrons on our Discord were debating whether they bought John and Jane's romantic chemistry. What did everyone think about this? Sarah Bunting, start us off with this one.
I was going to say more pertinent to previous comments, but this is partly an answer to what you just asked, that it's not easy to make Donald Glover seem like he can't do everything.
Yeah.
Right? Yes. And also he would have chemistry with like a wet, smelly towel. So there's also that. I didn't totally buy it, but I think that's actually kind of a credit to what Maya Erskine is doing with her character, that this is a much more withdrawn, I would say, or much more guarded character coming in. And I just didn't totally buy, and I've only seen two episodes, but I didn't totally buy like the timeline of it personally. But on the other hand, I think the show sort of has a good enough ear for itself and its world that it kind of finds a way to imply that a lot of relationships are completely not legible to outsiders anyway, and allows you to retcon it on that basis, even if it's not totally working for you. So all this by way of saying, I didn't totally buy it, but I also didn't really care enough to stop watching it. Like it wasn't fatal. Mm-hmm.
I didn't, in the early episodes, if you're supposed to buy that there was a spark between them that sort of slowly, you know,
kindles into a flame.
Thank you. Yes.
Yes.
Right.
Fire physics fail. That I didn't see that moment. And I don't necessarily think you need to. But as Sarah was saying, like, as it goes along, you get more of a sense of Jane's character and why that spark may have not sort of been clear and present.
Yeah.
And that's a little sort of like off the path from what we're expecting. I am super curious what the Phoebe Waller-Bridge version of this relationship would have been when she was.
Yeah.
I get the feeling that they were just two very strong-willed creators used to having almost total control over a project like this, and that's why it didn't work out, I'm gonna guess.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised. And maybe that would have felt a little bit different, a little bit lighter. But what they brought into this worked, but by the end of the season, you kind of understand why this might have been sort of not an overt romantic spark.
Yeah.
And the last episode, and we'll get into details, but the mechanics in which they sort of figure their shit out was very fun and clever as a good callback to something that happens at the start of the series. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed that. And it felt like a good way to demonstrate why it wasn't this sort of, you know, heart pumping out of your chest, Tex Avery sort of romance.
Yes.
And it works.
Yes.
But I will say, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Keep it.
If you're only in the first half of the series, you might not appreciate where they're going. So I'm just saying, once you watch the whole season, I think you'll get a better sense of exactly where that romance is going.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, too, like, if people are comparing it to the movie, which, you know, in, as I said, infamously.
Right. Because the movie's all like, hey, yeah.
Well, and also because of all the backstory that people knew by the time the movie came out, which is like, this is the movie that broke up a marriage. You know what I mean? Like, that was that sort of part of it, too. Agree about the Phoebe Waller-Bridge thing. And knowing, like, having watched, unfortunately, all of Run, and also knowing that, like, she did a polish on a Bond movie, like, I can imagine she had a different take on, like, how stylized this should be versus what we got. Anyway, Sarah Baker, what are your thoughts about the chemistry?
I would be very curious, too. And actually, I was talking to a friend about this last night, and she pointed out, too, like, Maya is a show creator also, but she's a collaborator. You know, she had a partner always. It sounds like they really liked each other as people when they met. And so I think they were still able to have that collaboration. She certainly had input. But yeah, maybe it wasn't such a, like, you know, far apart thing. And I had kind of a different take on the, like, what happens at the end of the second episode. Can we say? I don't know.
Yeah.
They do it.
You mean they do sex?
They do sex.
On each other? Okay.
On, with, and near, I think, each other. I felt like they both seemed like very lonely people to me. Mm-hmm. And I felt like being put into a marriage kind of made them both feel like, oh, here's an excuse to, like, married people have sex. So, like, let's have sex. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no reason we can't. Not that either of them was necessarily so into each other or that that was supposed to be the point, but that it was just like,
they were there.
I do think the sex thing got awakened by the very bizarre dog scenario they mm-hmm. were put into.
Mm. Yeah.
But I think it made their, especially Maya for some reason, maybe because I'm a woman, I don't know, it made her character more intriguing to me because I was like, what is behind that for her? Does she like him or is she like too, like, maybe, I don't know, it evoked more mystery to me about, like, what are their past? Clearly, mm-hmm. they're not attached, probably, but, like, has she had a serious relationship? Has she had a million relationships? Is she more of a casual sex person? Mm-hmm. I liked it because it felt like putting the cart before the horse in a good way.
Mm-hmm. There's definitely a lot to discover through this season, and I liked it so much more than I was expecting to, so I'm glad everyone is also on board, and I hope you guys continue to watch because it really goes places. That's all I'll say.
Literally.
Mm.
It's time to go around the dial. First stop, Tar.
Hello. A new season of Clone High dropped on Max last Thursday. I feel like no one anywhere is talking about it or aware that it happened at all, but it did. We talked about the revival when it premiered last summer. It took a while to establish all of its new clone characters, in my opinion, but by the finale, it did feel like it remembered how to be enjoyably weird. In an episode that very smartly braided together its sci-fi and its teen drama elements. So in the early going of the new season, Joan of Arc is dealing with the consequences of her choices in that episode and in watching how they write all her friends' anger and hurt along with the comedy. I realized, like, this might be the last teen drama on TV, kind of. Like, the CW isn't doing them anymore. You know, Riverdale is over. 13 Reasons Why is over. Never Have I Ever is over. Like, there's a couple of romantic-y shows on Prime and Netflix, but there isn't a show about a high school like that anymore. I feel like if you are a TV writer listening to this, get on it. It's an important genre that I still watch. Some stuff that was established in the first 10 episodes last summer pays off in an unexpected way, but a lot of other stuff gets abandoned that could have been really fun. For example, in an early episode in this season, Principal Scudworth gets the idea of saving money to finance his theme park, Cloney Island. by making Clone hire a religious school so that he can stop paying taxes. And so he tells Cleopatra and Frida Kahlo, who are a couple, that if they convince the other students religion is cool, he will make clones of them, like other clones of themselves, so that their clones can attend classes and they can like blow up school. And he does. And then that never goes anywhere. Like, we never see them again after that episode. What? Even though the board of shadowy figures got killed in the previous season finale, Candide, who is the new Krista Miller character that's like the boss of Scudworth, she's still acting like she's in charge of him. It never comes up like whom she is answering to now and for what purpose. But that aside, I mean, this is stuff you would never notice if you were not watching it and taking notes like a weirdo because you had to write a review of it. Hello. So ignore all that. If you enjoyed the other seasons, it is still mostly a weird, funny show. Mr. Butlerton is still the best. You will laugh a lot. So Clone High, all 10 episodes are out on Max. You heard it here probably first. And if you want more detail on that, I also did review it at Cracked. That's why I was taking notes. So you can find that link in the show notes.
Sarah Baker, what have you been watching recently?
Okay, so I went old school and picked a lowbrow and a highbrow.
Nice.
Rec. So for my lowbrow, The Floor. I'm just going to go ahead and assume that nobody has seen it, so I will explain it.
Please.
It's a trivia game where the contestants all have one little square on the floor, and each has their area of expertise, which, as the show goes on, you're like, did you get to pick, or did they just give you, like, you know, certain things? And you're like, I know kitchen tools, you know? So the randomizer picks one of the contestants, who then has to challenge any of the contestants whose square abuts theirs in a head-to-head duel. The catch being that the challenger, whoever they pick, they have to do the battle in the challengee's specialty category, not their own category.
Okay.
And then whoever wins gets to add the loser square to their, like, territory on the floor. Whoever has the largest area of the floor at the end of the episode wins $20,000. And then whoever takes over the whole floor by the end of the season wins, I think, $250,000. So, look, if you like Trivial, you'll probably like the show. It's the same contestants every day, so some of them get to be like characters because you kind of watch them through many of these duels. And they'll, you know, like, one will amass a huge thing and then somebody will come and take them down. And it's like, oh, my God, Joe's leaving, you know. So that is what I think differentiates it from a lot of other game shows, is that it's like ongoing with the contestants. Shout out to We Are Family, another show that's doing that. That's a little bit worse than this, but I'm also still watching. The duels are super fast, so things can kind of change on a dime, which keeps it interesting. And it's also like a strategy thing, because once you've dueled somebody, once the randomizer picked you, you did one duel, you can decide whether you want to then challenge somebody else or if you want to go back to the floor. And there's the short game of winning the 20,000 at the end of the night, but then the longer game of, I want to make sure I stay around, you know, so I can potentially win at the end. Mm. The only real downside is all the duels are done on screens. Like, you're seeing something on the screen that they have to name or whatever, mm-hmm. which works perfectly for something like, you know, a medical equipment category, which weirdly there was, where it's just, they show you the thing and they're like, otoscope, you know, and then not so well for, like, there was like a rock bands category and you're like, oh, they'll play music. No, it was like, it was images to evoke a name, like a pumpkin being smashed for smashing pumpkins, which are like a little convoluted. And then there was like a Simpsons category, which again, I was like, oh, this is fun. They showed photos of celebrities that have done guest voices on The Simpsons. I was like, well, that's not really about The Simpsons. But anyway, it's very enjoyable. I recommend.
How is Rob Lowe as a host?
He's fine. Okay. I mean, he kind of just has to be a person, because, and he's good at, you know, he seems relaxed to, like, he's basically chatting with the people, you know. Yeah, he's fine. Mm-hmm.
He really knocked it out of the park on Mental Samurai.
Also a Fox.
What's
show?
Mental Samurai?
That's the show he did before this on Fox. Yeah.
Oh, brother. Uh-huh. Yeah, no, this doesn't expect much of him, and he delivers, if okay. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
The Rob Lowe career trajectory.
So for my highbrow pick, Fargo season 5, And also seasons 1 and 2, if you haven't yet watched. I can't vouch for 3 or 4. Ironically, I feel like I have like less that I need to say about this than the floor.
Uh-huh.
But that's the fine. Cast and casting is extraordinary. You know, you get to see some actors you're familiar with in a different light, like Lamorne Morris and Dave Foley. You get to see somebody totally in their element playing a character seems like it was made for them, like Jennifer Jason Leigh, who's seemingly playing like her Hudsucker proxy character 30 years later. And then people not familiar to me, maybe less known, but I'm sure people have watched shows they've been on, like David Rizdahl as the believably incredibly naive husband, Risha Morjani as the local cop, and Sam Spruill, I hope I'm saying that right, as the like this weird, eternal, mysterious psychopath character. But the star is definitely the incredible Juno Temple, who is amazing. It's also a fun show to watch because so many shows are about character growth. And this is a show where it's a person just fighting to get back to where she started in a way. I mean, she does have to heal a lot of trauma along the way, but she's also just trying to get back to her life. And, you know, it's just every episode leaves you like your jaw dropped with either horror or shock or sadness, nervous delight. It's just so good. Save one very bad and cornily placed cover of Britney Spears' song Toxic. It's darn near perfect, I think.
Okay. Do you have anything you want to plug?
Yes, I would like to plug. I had the good fortune of being on a one season only show called Go On, which was on NBC with the late, great Matthew Perry. And it is. Oh, geez. Sorry. Sorry.
Oh, don't be sorry. It's okay.
Don't be.
Suck up on me. Gosh, now a decade ago, I had the luck of being on this show called Go on NBC, which only lasted a season, but has an amazing ensemble cast, almost all of which I'm still in close touch with now, and featuring the late, great Matthew Perry in kind of a different role for him that if you already love him from Chandler, you might, it's like adjacent, but different that you might like. And it's now finally streaming on Peacock, where it hasn't really been available anywhere in a long time. So I recommend check it out if you haven't.
And if you don't know what she's talking about, it's the show Goon.
Exactly.
According to us. Sarah D. Bunting.
Speaking of things that are on Peacock, for good or ill, Tara has her mid-season Married at First Sight reports. I have the biennial SVU rant.
Hey.
Hello. Here it is. So, I recently realized that Law & Order SVU is back for its 25th season, and also that for whatever reason, I had not gotten around to watching like two-thirds of its 24th season. LOL, whatever reason. The reason is it's bad. But I think my motive was actually that I did not understand why it was necessary to churn Kelly Giddish's Amanda Rollins out of the squad room when they had just done that particular dirtiness to another lady detective in the cast. Also, because, you know I overuse this analogy, but I do it because it's apt. The show is basically if the Thermians from Galaxy Quest, having saved their civilization from extinction, were now using the historical documents to recreate police procedurals. It looks uncannily similar to Earth SVU. Crimes happen in it. Benson is there with great hair. And yet, actually, this comparison is not fair to the Thermians, because everything about SVU that is bad or weird is just getting worse and weirder. And keep in mind, I am still not done with season 24, but like, Rollins' departure bore no resemblance to, never mind a realistic timeline, a timeline we could even follow. The actual final episode is a tear-soaked self-indulgence that forced Giddish to proclaim her love for Benson and vice versa, for like 10 minutes. Also, Noah Benson is back. And he has a half-brother, because this family is just a fucking hydra of half-siblings whenever it's a sweeps period. And in addition to nobody caring, the writers still insist on saddling Benson with stiffly formal dad's new girlfriend writing of their day-to-day conversations. Like, the child is meant to be 12 is one thing. And another thing, Hargitay has 3 literal teenagers of her own IRL, and if she's going to insist on writing for Benson that casts her as Captain Mary Sue, the badass victim advocate all the time, She should also be insisting on staff writers who have or have even ever met a child between the ages of 5 and 15, or at the very least, that she not have to close an episode by reading a bedtime story to Emmy winner Bradley Whitford, whose character is living with dementia, which I also felt like I was living with after watching the scene, which bore no relationship to Earth reality and could not have taken itself more seriously if it were a goddamn state funeral. And furthermore, the show is also trying to have it both ways as far as a cop show's inherent propaganda. It's performatively proving that it, capital G, gets it about systemic law enforcement incompetence, bias, and corruption by seating more than one plotline in departments outside Manhattan SVU, then standing back all, but we're not like that. The cold opens get ever more elaborate and 6 feet under-esque. Benson is saying shit like, life is such an odd mix of beauty and pain, but like, you're in the break room? And characters whose actors really should not be tasked with such things are taking it personally in showcase episodes. Like, I love iced tea, but the moistly active listening a bottle episode of SVU requires here in the 2020s is not his acting forte. Mm-mm. I'm sure it gets even worse. Stabler tried to French Benson after carpooling Noah home from a safe house playdate.
No.
People keep asking me what on the Discord what I think of XYZ development, and I'm like, I haven't seen it, but it's stupid and unacceptable because that's the show. It's not all terrible. They got a character named Muncie. Sometimes people are a little sinusy. It sounds like Buncy. I'll take it.
Sure.
And cutie Kevin Kane is playing a weird Serpico Fontana hybrid. I don't hate that. I can't stop hate watching it, but at least I've got some shit to look at. Here endeth the rant. See you in 2026. It's a savory liminal space. That, yes, Kevin Kane, colon, savory liminal space. For my plug, another place we really like to talk about liminal spaces is Mastass. We are back with a new season, Weird Al versus Everybody. In each episode, we talk about a Weird Al hit and the song that inspired it, and then we pick a winner. Here's the twist. For this season, we're releasing 2 episodes a week, but only Patreon supporters get the second weekly joint, so come through to patreon.com/mastass so you'll get the full 24 episodes. That's any level of support. And at certain levels of support, you can help us determine the winner in our polls. Democracy in action. Let's do it.
I just wanted to say for the listener at home, how many of you, every time Sarah D. Bunting said Benson, pictured Robert Guillaume? Was it just me?
It would be a huge improvement.
I think it was everyone.
Angels hear our cry.
All right, here's what's coming up on the Greater Extra Hot Great Cinematic Universe. This Friday on Extra Extra Hot Great, we talk about Curb Your Enthusiasm, the final season. Season 12, we are informed eagle-eye viewers can see one Sarah Baker sometime during the season. Woo! We're not going to tell you when. We're not going to tell you where. But you're going to have to find out for yourself by watching. That's right. We're in HBO's deep pockets now. You can go to extrahotgreat.com/club to join the club and get those episodes.
And we are very, 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 very close to our next campaign milestone. We are, as of this recording, $29 away from unlocking the next perk, which is this month in historical TV, a drill down on the pop culture world that was. This is something we have enjoyed doing in the past. We will enjoy doing it in the future if you get us there. extrahotgreat.com/club.
All right, and then right here on EHG Prime next week, we welcome back David J. Roth to talk about the post-Super Bowl premiere, CBS Presents Tracker. No idea what it's about. We'll find out next week.
Dear Mr. President, there are too many states nowadays. Please eliminate 3. I am not a crackpot.
Oh, hi. It's me, Detective Buncey. You may have heard that Sam Waterston is leaving Law & Order Mothership after hundreds of thousands of episodes, first as executive ADA, then DA, Jack McCoy. Replacing him in the district attorney role is Tony Goldwyn of Cuffs. Fine. Also of Scandal. My fellow scholars of the Dick Wolf cinematic universe know that Goldwyn has already played a role of note in this universe, namely Frank Gorin, troubled older half-brother of Detective Robert. Actually, it's pronounced Ashole. Let me explain why, using the tale of Genji and a master's in mycology, Gorin, in the Criminal Intent franchise. Said scholars also know that Frank Gorin, who struggled with drug and gambling addictions before the show's struggle with its addiction to stupid Nicole Wallace, wound up taking Frank out in the 7th season finale. And we saw the body twice. But I am still not a crackpot for thinking Mothership should just name the new DA character Frank Gorin, make it the same dude, and just never explain it. Makes kind of a fun Easter egg. It lets you bring Robert Gorin and or Eames back in for sweeps episodes. Why not? Yes, they both would have retired by now, but for them to look at Frank Gorin and be like, "You're Frank Gorin, right?" And he'd be like, "Uh-huh." And they'd be like, "And?" And he'd be like, "What? I don't know. I think that's funny. Fuck it. It can't be any more bizarre than Hugh Dancy's accent in this shit. So why not?" And the show's Emmy bait rococo treatment of Bobby Gorin's entire family and personal life means that a backstory in which Frank faked his own death with Emmy Rogers' help, went into WITSEC, got a law degree, married a minor Kennedy, and set his sights on redemptive public office is not even close to the most baroque plot that either of those characters was involved with. But again, don't even explain it. Let Reddit fever dream up some bullshit and say nothing about it on camera. Manhattan District Attorney Francis Scott Key Gorin, ladies and germs, I am not a crackpot.
It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is Julie Rhymes with Sully. Take it away, Julie.
Every family has their own television Rosetta Stone. In mine, it's MASH. And thanks to a mention of it on the Discord, I recently visited Season 3, Episode 11, Adam's Rib. It's my favorite type of sitcom episode. Nothing really happens, and thus the episode depends on great writing, timing, and chemistry to keep us watching. The episode reminds us that wartime involves a lot of downtime and a lot of boredom. The unit's days are marked by golf games and drinking, and the only sense of time is passing is mealtime. In his ennui, Hawkeye is left to obsess about the terrible food they're being forced to eat. Clip one.
Succotash, Doc?
Yes, please.
Potatoes?
Fine.
Green corn?
Thank you.
And for the entree today?
Here it comes.
Steady.
We have liver or fish?
I didn't hear you say that. Because it isn't possible. It's inhuman to serve the same food day after day. The Geneva Convention prohibits the killing of our taste buds. I simply cannot eat the same food every day. Fish, liver, day after day. I've eaten a river of liver and an ocean of fish. I've eaten so much fish, I'm ready to grow gills. I've eaten so much liver, I can only make love if I'm smothered in bacon and onions. Are we gonna stand for this? We're gonna let them do this to us? No, I say, no! We're not going to eat this dreck anymore! We want something else! We want something else! We want something else!
This is Alan Alda as Hawkeye at his best. The clever wordplay, charisma, and physical comedy. And add to it, Klinger doing that little Roomba arm gesture and Radar continuing to stuff his face with food despite the chaos around him. After a passing comment from Colonel Blake, Hawkeye starts craving the spare ribs he ate at a restaurant called Adam's Rib in Chicago. Because there's nothing else to do, he dragoons Radar and McIntyre into an elaborate plan to order the ribs and get them shipped to Korea, which involves a complex series of phone calls and favors to the States. Even as the laughs are coming, we never forget we're in the middle of the war, even if it's a war that everyone back in the States wants to forget. Clips 2, 3, and 4 in succession.
Hello? San Francisco? Right. Can you speak up a little louder, please? I'm calling from Korea. Korea! Rhymes with Daya. Right, the place that Bob Hope comes to all the time.
Hello? What do you mean, busy? Operator, I'm a soldier. I'm a wounded man in Korea. I'm trying to reach my family from a foxhole.
Oh, Hey, hold on.
Go. Hi, Mildred. This is John McIntyre. That's right, Big John.
Big John?
Bucky.
Look, honey, I know it's been a lot of years, but, no, I'm not actually in Chicago now, a little bit west of there. I'm in Korea, to be exact. Well, I got called up into the war, and, I got to thinking about you. What? The war, Mildred. The war!
Come on, you guys, take it easy. You're worse than the real thing.
Hawkeye's plan is brilliantly realized until it gets held up at a storage depot by wartime bureaucracy, one of the show's favorite targets. Clip 5.
Nobody cut requisition orders on this.
Emergency medical shipment, Sergeant.
Yeah, there's no S-47-19J accompanying.
I told you we should have got an S-47-19J accompanying, but you wouldn't listen.
That's necessary?
Necessary? We don't go to latrine around here without an S-47-19J. Sorry.
You know, I wasn't going to say anything, but this little supermarket of yours here isn't all that clean.
Yeah. Ideal breeding environment for cholera. The plague.
You're kidding.
You always sweat in 40-degree temperature?
I'm not sweating.
You should be.
Nothing wrong with me. I feel sensational.
There it is. Say that again, will you?
I feel sensational?
Definite slurring of the S.
Classic early symptom. Followed by the eyes blinking in an up-and-down motion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's plague here, we'll have to close the place.
Post it as a contagious area.
Give you a chance to be reassigned.
You're probably anxious to get up to the fighting war anyway, aren't you?
What's in the package?
Spare ribs and sauce from Chicago.
Adam's ribs?
You know?
I'm from Joliet. I'd walk to Chicago on my knees in the snow for a takeout order.
He's one of you.
How many you got?
40 pounds.
I'll take 20 and a quart of sauce.
10 and a pint of sauce.
12 and a pint and a half. And coleslaw.
We didn't order any coleslaw.
You sent all the way to Chicago and no coleslaw?
Forgive us, we're draftees.
The sound of choppers is usually the sound of bad news, but this one is carrying ribs. And as the ribs are being served in the mess, it's really hard not to look at them as a metaphor for the war's carnage. There are a bunch of surgeons at a table, implements in hand, ready to devour the only animal part that actually looks like human anatomy. And then we hear the inevitable incoming wounded over the PA system, and Hawkeye has to be dragged away, ribs interruptus. Larry Gelbart was one of the screenwriters on this episode, and I have to assume he did the bulk of the work on it. The rat-a-tat pacing, the literary references to Cole Porter and Carl Sandburg, not to mention the ones I was too lazy to research, the rib puns, and even the blessed absence of a bee storyline, most appreciate it, as it probably would have involved Burns and Hot Lips, evokes some of my favorite television shows, from The West Wing to 30 Rock to Brooklyn Nine-Nine, where government bureaucracy was also often mined for comedy gold. Indulge me this one. Clip 6.
I'm not saying anything.
Look, punk, there are two ways we can do this. The easy way or the hard way.
Tell them what the hard way is, boss.
Well, first, Stephen, we're going to fill out form 38E-J1 stating noncompliance. We send it to the DA, but do they process it right away? No, because they're overwhelmed.
So, think not only of Andre Brower, rest in peace, but of baby Gen X Julie, who couldn't stand watching Little House on the Prairie, but had an adult-sized appreciation for the rib-tickling humor of MASH, and vote this one into the canon.
Thank you, Julie. Sarah Baker, you chose this one from our list of submissions. Please, start us off.
I'm a total MASH head. Love MASH. I have no objectivity about it because I watched it as a child. Mm-hmm. So I just love it. Love Hawkeye. It was probably the first TV show I really like fell in love with. Loved all the characters or loved to hate them. Grew up and realized that some of the bad, mean characters that I hated when I was little are the funniest characters, like Larry Linville as Frank. I am so torn. I love the show. Great presentation. I do think she's right. Like, you know, it's hard to get 122 or 23 back in the day minute episode of television to do everything that the show does. And this does do the like fast-paced, fun, funny, charged Hawkeye thing really well. It, you know, has great radar moments too, like goddamn radar being woken up in bed with his little teddy bear, you know, just love it so much. And she makes me see the symbolism of it more, like, okay, bringing the ribs and then not getting to eat them. My like weird brain goes like, let him have one bite. He can't have one bite before he goes. We can't have that satisfaction. He can't have it. And also like, they're just going to leave them there. They have to put them away. They can reheat them later.
That's what I said. At least cover them.
I know. So stuff like that, I tend to get mired down in details that are not in the world of interesting television. I mean, I do love the show, and it is some great Hawkeye. I mean, to me, if I was going to pitch a MASH episode to you guys, which I would never dare do, I would pick maybe like the one where Blake's, you know, plane goes down and he ends up being dead just because it's such a classic. But this is a great episode. She's given me a lot to ponder, and I enjoyed watching it. It was fun to watch again.
Thank you so much. I'll go next. It's funny to be talking about this now, just a week after we were talking about Masters of the Air, because this, you know, one of my complaints about that one, I mean, I said it in the context of comparing it to the Catch 22 TV show from Hulu a few years ago. But what that was missing for me was wit. And obviously, this has it in spades, but it also captures, like Julie said, the futility, which is what Catch 22 is about as well. And so that, you know, that it has to end on this unsatisfying note is, of course, part of it. And like, you know, we get it. But in addition to that, I was just fascinated by all of the world building that like brings the viewer inside what it would actually take in a world before Goldbelly to get food delivered like this. And I said, as we were like late in the process when Trapper and Hawkeye are trying to find someone to like actually bring it to the airport, it's like, this is season four of For All Mankind, except this is like, it was as hard to get these ribs to Korea in the 50s as it is to get, you know, all of the black market shit to Mars in the speculative For All Mankind world.
It is as hard to get ribs to Korea as it is to get Koreans to Mars.
That's right. Exactly. I was fascinated by every step of this process of like, you have a vague memory also before the internet, like of it's a place, it's by this train station. I don't remember what it's called. You have to call. I mean, he should have called the library, frankly. They would have known all of this information. A librarian would have hooked him up immediately. But when they kept repeating the phone number for the Dearborn train station, so I Googled it, and, you know, there was a note about this episode, of course, and I found out the real station was a Klondike 4 number, which is so funny, because that's what they always say in old TV shows, because it's 555.
KL5, yep.
This was 554. I feel like what this episode does so well is, like I said, brings the viewer into the world. It makes you feel both the frustration that kicks off like the premise of the episode and then the ingenuity that goes into solving the problem. And you just feel like you have a 360 view of like what this world is. And that's what's so often missing from shows where you come up with a big premise and then you don't bother to think through all of the implications of it. And I said, this is the dumb example, but after we finish the episode, this is one of the things that bothered me about Under the Dome, is that you had this huge idea and then nobody thought through all of the implications of like what it would mean if you were actually in it. So I thought this was great. We've had a checkered past with this show. Someone else pitched the finale and we all were like, no, because it was a million hours long. But this was a joy and I loved it. Sarah.
My late mother had a really complicated relationship with MASH, both the show and the movie. She thought the movie was brilliant and basically never wanted to see it again or watch the show because they really got at, my grandfather was a colonel dentist in this man's army, and she felt that both properties really got at like this essential futility. And like, I just wrote down every single army foobar aspect of this that Barb would have appreciated. Like that they ordered frozen turkeys and they got jock straps. fucking classic army. you know, there's like enough time and sort of latitude to try to pull off a caper like this. But then once General MacArthur's name is invoked, Radar has this throwaway line that he's like, oh, great, I've never been to the stockade before. And you're just like, mm-hmm. Like, this is also the kind of thing that would get you max punished to be an example to other grunts. So in that regard, I thought that it was really effective and that it had that same quality. I love the movie. I've seen it a bunch of times. It had that same quality of fiddling while Rome burned, sort of like, fuck it, nihilist humor. Like, they're, you know, the pros from Dover and they're going to go play golf and all this stuff. Like, that's what great episodes of MASH have versus that self-important, like, late 70s, early 80s, very special episode shit that sometimes people try to pitch for the canon and we're like, well, that's not going to work. But like Pole Position early season MASH, I think, is much more effective at capturing that tone. I also felt like in the opening, like 4 or 5 minutes when they're establishing that army food is terrible and such large portions, and that there was like a Catskillsiness to it that usually I enjoy, but Alan Alda was like, it just felt very strained and like big and off tone, but the pace of it is relentless. And the writer or writers of this episode understood that they just had to keep it, like had to keep the line moving and that there would be a cumulative effect. And they were right. So like by minute 14, I'm like, okay, not every joke is hitting. Some of this is too big and they're standing back and waiting for the laugh track, but they're like, they're keeping it moving. And by the time they get to like that back third and it starts paying off, they've absolutely earned it. Like, I respect the effect, but I respect looking at the back of the tapestry to see how it was woven. So this was like quite a sort of interesting meta watch, but it was also just a fun watch and a good presentation. And it might be slightly off brand for early MASH, but I think it does showcase the things that the show did well and did importantly versus self-importantly, which is where the show can sometimes run into trouble with this panel. So great presentation and good episode. 50 years old almost, this episode. Geez. Yikes. David T. Cole, take us home.
50 years old, but still feels very modern. Mm-hmm. You can tell that the people that watched this and at an informative age grew up to run shows like, I'm guessing, Arrested Development and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. The rat-a-tat nature of some of these episodes, especially the early episodes that Sarah was saying, are very evocative of the pacing that we would come to associate with sort of golden age television, you know, new golden age television sitcoms and stuff. That kind of started in the aughts. This one does things that MASH does, which is, you know, the banality of being in combat, the bureaucracy of it all, the boredom of it all at times. And some episodes of MASH do that. Some are like, oh, all the shit has hit the fan all at once. That is the nature of the series. So I don't know if you're ever going to get one episode that does it all that is satisfying, because I think it's a bit of a, you know, a hodgepodge. Mm. As in anybody's lives outside of war, there are many moods to being in a MASH unit, I would imagine. And this is one of them, which is, oh my fucking God, fucking liver again. Like, I understand. I mean, I don't eat liver. I've never eaten liver. I never will.
No.
But that notion that, oh my God, we're on day 17 of this giant fucking pot of chili I made. And I like my chili, but on day 17, Tara will gladly eat a salad instead of having another bowl of chili.
Let's not get crazy.
Okay.
Yeah, come on.
That is what this episode captures so well. What I really hated about the finale is how self-important it was and how, you know, you can tell people like Alan Alda were trying to, you know, one-up themselves on things that they were congratulated for earlier in the season when they're doing it with more finesse. And this one, I feel like, does a lot of things and says a lot of things about being in a conflict in a very smart and comedic way without loading it down with, you know, it wasn't a chicken after all. Oh, no.
Yeah. So like, we're talking about Vietnam. Oh, yeah. Word.
Yeah. And I would enjoy MASH halfway between this episode and that episode as well. Like, there's the spectrum to MASH where I'm like, yep, 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 yep. breaks. No more of that, please. And the finale definitely went over that. And this is on the safe side of what I enjoy. And I enjoyed the comedy in this episode. It is really good. It is really smart. You know, the scene where the doctors are threatening to shut down one of the depots with, you know, a cholera declaration. And yes, that kicks off like the negotiation of, yes, how much, you know, that's really great.
Into the true shame of like, forgot to order.
I forgot to get a coleslaw. Yeah.
Forgive us, we're drafties, was like, oh, yes, chef's kiss. Yes. So good.
I enjoyed this episode quite a bit. All right, yeah, let's put this to the official vote. I'm interested to see how it happens. Sarah Baker, what do you think? You got to make a decision.
You guys have made me realize that when it comes to MASH, I have a bad taste, and I like the schmaltzy episodes. The sadder, the better. But I did also really like this episode, and yeah, I think you're right, Dave. I don't think you can get everything in one episode. And this was all the things that are great about Hawkeye and about the fun, fast, funny writing. So I will vote yes.
All right. There is a very famous little snippet of Futurama where they do a MASH parody and, yes, there's a Hawkeye. Do you know it? Okay. Well, this is, that's
it's
you.
It's like Maudlin and, yes, I forget what the other, Wacky and Maudlin means.
Reverence or something. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that is you. You just need to flip the switch where you want it to go.
Yeah.
That's all. All right. Tara, where are you voting here?
It's a yes for me as well.
Sarah.
Talk myself into it. It's a yes.
All right. That means 4-4. Woo! MASH Season 3, Episode 11, Adam's Ribs. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time to discover the winner and the loser of the week. Tara has this week's winner.
Well, I'm going to give a little background first, which is that after Phil Rosenthal had a very successful show about traveling around and eating food, every other comic person thought that they could do a travel show, which is how we have a Rainn Wilson travel show and a Eugene Levy travel show and a travel show with Anthony Anderson and his fucking mom that he does everything with now for some reason. All of those can go to hell because we just had announced the only one that will matter and the only one I will ever care about, which is Alan Partridge, a.k.a. Steve Coogan, is going to be doing a travelogue show in character, and it's going to start shooting this summer, and I can't wait. It's been too long since we had a new season of an Alan Partridge show. I recently discovered last week that This Time, a show that he did a few years ago, got a second season, and so I have flown to England to acquire it, so that will have to be my methadone until we get And Did Those Feet, starring Alan Partridge. Hooray.
What about that show you like with Adam Pally?
Oh, yeah, okay, that's the exception to the rule. Yes, 100 places to visit before you die or something like that. Go. To drink, maybe? Anyway, that's probably not getting renewed. No. But yes, with Adam Pally and John Gabris. That one is funny.
And who is our loser of the week, Sarah?
Okay, well, technically, it's the trolls who are blowing up Alyssa Milano Bugliari's son's Instagram after she shared his baseball travel team's GoFundMe. But also, it's her for a bunch of reasons, starting with the fact that she waded in the first place, got involved, and then gave the story oxygen by complaining about the trolling. Like,
can't do that.
Kid was actually handling it perfectly well by himself. I think, like, one of his comments was like, but like, fuck off, you know, I'm 12, right? Like,
yeah,
what are you doing? Mm-hmm. And then Alyssa Milano also used an appearance at a con to reopen the can of worms about Shannen Doherty, alleging that Alyssa Milano got her fired from Charmed. And the other three Hallowells who had a panel at that same con, but without Alyssa Milano, were absolutely not having it. And Shannen Doherty read a, I'm sure, fully legally vetted statement that was like, this is my recollection. And Holly Marie Combs is like, no lies detected. So, yeah, this is getting increasingly ugly, and I think Alyssa Milano should just not read the comments, and that her agent husband should get between her and her screens for like a month.
Speaking about getting increasingly ugly, do you know what time it is?
It's game time!
Yeah!
All right, it is still early days in the season. This is our second game. Tara won the first. Today, we are playing TV popularity contest from Miles Gordon, who earns himself an extra credit. Topic of his choosing, plus a free shirt or mug or whatever he wants from the EHG store at throughmethods.com. Miles writes, when you search a show on IMDb, you see the cast listed in credit order. You may not know that I'll also let you resort the cast list by IMD popularity.
Ooh.
In this game, you score points for identifying the IMDb's most popular actors from various TV shows. I'm going to give you the top four credited actors as a clue. Any of those four might be on the most popular list, or maybe someone else is who has appeared on the show. In round one, you'll get 4 points for naming the most popular, 3 points for the second, 2 points for the third, and 1 point for the fourth. So inverse point system here. Mm-hmm. I'll give you the show name, and then all you contestants have to lock in your guess. So we're not going in order. It's all sort of all happening at once. Mm-hmm. If I didn't trust everybody, you'd write it down, but I'm going to trust you to lock in your guesses and not change it based on what other people say. Are we all honest people here?
Of course.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, fine. Internet popularity is calculated using several statistical indicators, including the frequency and the number of people access a person's page or credits on IMDb. For the purposes of this game, only actors who have appeared in 5 or more episodes are being considered.
Okay.
So regular cast and frequent guest stars only are the kind of people that you will be dealing with.
Okay.
Here is an example. The show is Hacks. So let's say Tara guesses Hannah Enbiner.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah and other Sarah both guess Jean Smart. IMDb's most popular actors in 5 or more episodes of Hacks are Caitlin Olsen, number 1, Jean Smart, number 2, Christopher McDonald, number 3, Jane Addams, number 4. So Tara would get no points, and Sarah and Sarah would both get 3 points for guessing the second most popular actor. So you have to think out of the box here. Mm-hmm. It could be just a very famous guest star that was in 5 episodes that's going to be at the top of the list for any particular show.
Right.
All right, no steel meals. There's no picky needed. So let's get to it with round one. Are we ready to play TV popularity contest?
Yes.
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 Hands up when you're locked in for my benefit, please.
Okay.
Our first show, round one, is Ted Lasso. Credits order is Jason Sudeikis, Hannah Waddingham, Jeremy Swift, Phil Dunster. Now you have to try to figure out who is the most popular actor or actress from Ted Lasso. Might be one of those fours, might be somebody else entirely. May not even be a regular cast member. Could be somebody that guested on a whole bunch of episodes that people just fucking love.
Oh, okay, I see. So we can say people that you did not list.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
All right, we are locked in. Sarah Baker, who do you got?
This is boring, but I think Jason Sudeikis.
Jason Sudeikis will net you 2 points. He is the third most popular.
Oh.
Sarah Bunting.
I also guessed Sudeikis.
2 points. Tara?
I'm going to say Hannah Waddingham.
3 points. She is the second. Number one, Juno Temple.
Oh, sure.
And number four, Brett Goldstein. See, there you go. That's how you have to think it out. All right. Show number two is Freaks and Geeks. Credit order, Linda Cardellini, John Francis Daly, James Franco, Sam Levine. We are locked in. Sarah Baker making a terrible scrunchy face. Not happy with her answer. Let's go to Sarah D. Bunting first here.
Busy Phillips.
Busy Phillips will get you 3 points. She is number 2. Tara.
Nice. I said Seth Rogen.
Seth Rogen is number 4. One point. Sarah Baker.
Nice. James Franco.
James Franco is number 3. So you get 2 points.
Woo!
Linda Cardellini was number 1.
Really?
Good for her.
That's shocking, but good for her indeed.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I lied before. There is animated shows here.
Oh, okay.
Show number 3 is the original Clone High. So I guess they're listed separately in IMDb, apparently. So this would be the original run, first season of Clone High. Your credits order is Will Forte, Phil Lord, Michael McDonald, Krista Miller.
Oh, shit.
Tara is locked in with an oh, shit.
Yeah.
Sarah Baker locked in. Sarah D. Bunting locked in. Let's go to Tara first.
I'm gonna guess it's either, I'm going to say Phil Lord.
Phil Lord?
Because I think they are probably Googled more because of the Spider-Man.
That is the way you should be thinking, but I got not on the top 4.
Damn!
Sarah Baker.
despite many years of listening to this podcast, I still have not watched Clone High, so I can only guess from the top four. So I guess Will Forte.
Will Forte will give you 2 points. He is number three. Sarity Bunting.
I also went with Forte, although I considered Andy Dick, but the 5-episode rule made me shiver. So.
All right, that gives you 2 points. Here is your actual order. Number one, search for Krista Miller. Number two, Donald Faison. Number three, Will Forte. Number four, Nicole Sullivan.
Sure.
All right, we are now doing The Office US, the US version of The Office. Credit order on IMDb is Rainn Wilson, John Krasinski, Jenna Fischer, Leslie David Baker. All right, everybody's locked in. Sarah Baker, who do you got?
This is the one I thought of when you first posed the topic, and it could burn me, but I'm going to say Will Ferrell.
Will Ferrell is not on the list. Sarah D. Bunting.
Steve Carell.
Steve Carell, number three for 2 points. Tara.
I had Steve Carell as well.
That is the same. Number three, 2 points. Jenna Fischer, number one. John Krasinski, number two.
Sure.
Steve Carell, number three. James Spader is
I
your
thought
boy.
About Spader.
All right, Tara. Friends.
Uh-huh.
Friends. Jennifer Aniston, Courtney Cox, Lisa Kudrow, Matt LeBlanc is your credits order on IMDb. Everybody's locked in. We'll go to Sarah D. Bunting first.
Matthew Perry.
Matthew Perry is number two for 3 points. Tara.
I had Matthew Perry as well.
All right. The same. And Sarah Baker.
I had Matthew Perry as well.
All right. 3 points for everybody for Friends. Your number one answer, Jennifer Aniston. Number two, Matthew Perry. Number three, and your guess is not a friend.
Maggie Wheeler?
Paul Rudd.
Christina Applegate?
Oh, Paul Rudd, sure.
And number four, Padgett Brewster.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
Cheers is your next show. Credits order on IMDb is Ted Danson, Rhea Perlman, John Ratzenberger, George Wendt. All right, we are locked in. Tara?
I think it's probably Ted Danson.
Ted Danson is not on the list.
Whoa!
Sarah Baker.
I thought Kelsey Grammer.
Kelsey Grammer is not on the list.
Dang.
What?
Sarah D. Bunting.
Harrelson?
Harrelson is number one. Our first number one answer of the game.
For four points, right?
4 points. Wow. Harrelson, Christy Alley, Rhea Perlman, Shelley Long.
Oh, okay. Still. Right.
Last show of round one, guys.
Okay.
Breaking Bad. We've got Bryan Cranston, Anna Gunn, Aaron Paul, Betsy Brandt. Everybody's locked in. We're going to go to Sarah Baker first.
Bryan Cranston.
Bryan Cranston is our number three. That'll get you 2 points to Sarah D. Bunting.
I choked and also said Bryan Cranston.
Okay.
So 2 points.
2 points. Tara.
I'm going to say Bob Odenkirk.
Bob Odenkirk, number two. Ooh. For 3 points.
Nice.
Number one, just out in left field here. I mean, he was in a lot of episodes.
Mark Margolis?
No, Jesse Plemons.
Oh, okay, yeah.
When
okay.
Life gives you Plemons.
You make Plemonade.
You make Plemonade.
The actor's name who plays Mike Ehrmantraut.
But oh, Jonathan
Banks.
Be an
avant-garde show. Yes.
Well, good thing you didn't guess, because he's not fourth. Fourth is Gus Fring. It's Giancarlo Esposito.
Of course, Giancarlo.
All right, that is round one. Let's get the scores.
Close at the bottom, Sarah Baker has 11, I have 12. Sarah D. Bunting killing it with 18 points.
All right. Miles Gordon is upping up the difficulty level for round two.
Oh, no. Okay.
The points double, but you get no hint at the start. We're just going to name the show, and then you have to go straight to locking in your guesses.
Okay.
So if you absolutely don't know the show, you are up, as we'll discover later, Schitt's Creek.
Oh,
here we go with round two. Your first show is Succession. Succession. Lock in your answer. Who do you think is number one on the IMDb popularity list for Succession? All right. Everybody's locked in. We're going to Sarah D. Bunting here.
Coxie. Brian Cox.
Brian Cox is not on the list.
Wow.
Not on the list.
Between him and the person I did pick.
You picked?
I picked Matthew McFadden.
Matthew McFadden, he is fourth, so you get 2 points there.
Okay.
Ooh, okay.
And Sarah Baker, who do you got?
I picked Brian Cox.
No points for you. All right, Kieran Culkin, number one.
But I do get points for my honesty.
All right. Alexander Skarsgård is your number two.
Mm.
Sarah Snook is your number three. Now, the thing to remember, I'm sure you figured this out, it's not who's the most popular for the show. It's who's the most popular over IMDb. Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
So, you know, if you know, the sexiest person alive is somehow on this show.
I know, but I still thought, like, Brian Cox is getting Googled or whatever, looked up a lot, because he keeps being in the news for saying wild shit.
Well, yeah. I think you're underestimating what a bunch of horn dogs are just on IMDb.
That's a great point.
Here we go. Next show, 30 Rock. 30 Rock is your next show. Tara locked in. Oh, boy, I want to make a screen grab right now. Sarah Baker locked in. Sarah Bunting locked in. Tara Ariano, start us off.
On the theory of who's getting looked up lately, Alec Baldwin.
Alec Baldwin is not on your list.
Whoa!
Wow. Sarah Baker.
I went with another Will Ferrell option, which was not good the first time. John Hamm?
John Hamm is on the list. He is number two. Woo! 6 points.
Six points.
Wow. Nicely done. Sarah D. Bunting.
Baldwin,
no points. All right, your number one is somebody who's on the show a lot but not a cast member. Let's go with the horn dog theory by David T. Cole. Any guesses? That's Elizabeth Banks.
Sure.
Number two was John Hamm. Number three, Tina Fey. Number four, Julianne Moore. Like the vegetable cut.
Yes, Julianne Moore.
Yes. All right.
Tiny slivers of acting.
Sarah D. Bunting, get ready for The Sopranos, which is your next show. Sopranos. Lock in your choices.
Oh, no. Oh.
The Sopranos. All right. Everybody's locked in. Let's go to Sarah Baker first.
James Gandolfini.
He is your number four for 2 points. Sarah D. Bunting.
Imperioli.
No.
Lotus gets him nothing.
Only Sarah Baker picks up points. Drea Di Matteo is your number one.
Horn dog theory bears out.
Only fans.
Yeah.
Lorraine Bracco, number two. Mm-hmm. Jamie Lynn Sigler, number three.
Mm-hmm.
James Gandolfini running it out. Your next show is Community. 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 Sarah Baker pondering her choice.
Oh, I forgot.
All right, there we go. Sarah D. Bunting, start us off.
Joel McHale.
Joel McHale is not on the list.
That's who I had to.
God,
Tara, no points for Tara.
Damn.
Sarah Baker.
I went with one of my besties, sentimental favorite, Jim Rash.
Jim Rash, also not on the list. No points for anybody on Community. Number one, guys, I don't know, we didn't get caught into the strategy. Allison Brie. Number two, Gillian Jacobs. Number three, Donald Glover. Number four, Keith David. Good for him.
People are horny for Joel McHale. Not me, but, you know, he's tall.
All right, as promised, Schitt's Creek is your next show. Schitt's Creek. All right, everybody is locked in. Tara, start us off.
Well, I guess I have to say Annie Murphy.
Annie Murphy, number three, 4 points.
Smart.
Sarah Baker.
Catherine O'Hara.
Catherine O'Hara is your number four for 2 points. Sarah D. Bunting.
You know how ladies love cool Levy? Eugene?
Oh, Eugene Levy. No, not on the list. Dan Levy was your number two. Emily Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who that is.
Hampshire? Like the state.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know.
Did you know that Schitt's Creek has its own branded yarn line?
No, but that makes sense.
Wow.
Sweaters were a big deal on that show. It's one of the facts I know about it, not having watched.
It's fine to work with and reasonably priced. I don't work for them.
Got two more shows in round two, guys.
Okay.
Full House is your next one. Full House.
Ooh.
Everybody's locked in. We're going to go to Sarah Baker first.
Candace Cameron Barfe.
Sarah points.
She is our third for 4 points. Sarah D. Bunting.
Lori Loughlin.
She is our fourth for 2 points.
Finally. I had Lori as well.
And that is another 2 points. Number one, Jodie Sweetin.
Oh.
Number two, Journey Smollett.
Okay.
Oh, sure.
Wasn't that person like in some scandal recently?
No, her brother was. Journey is the girl who was in Birds of Prey.
All right. Well, be impressed I knew that much.
Yeah, I am.
And I'm going to guess that's maybe the reason why.
She's also an actress in her own.
Fine.
She was on Friday Night Lights. Mm-hmm. All right.
She's around.
White Lotus.
Yeah.
White Lotus is your next show.
Oh, gosh. So all seasons, huh?
All seasons. And just for your information, I did a quick turnover on this. All the data was collected in late January. So okay. This is all current data.
Okay.
Everybody's locked in now. All right. Let's go to Sarah D. Bunting.
Jennifer Coolidge.
Jennifer Coolidge is your number three for 4 points. Tara.
Sydney Sweeney.
Our second number one guest of the game.
Hey,
wow.
That smart. Is 8 points.
Damn.
Sarah Baker.
I too had Jennifer Coolidge.
All right. So you get 4 points. Alexandria Daddario is your number two.
Oh, of course.
Theo James is your number four.
He's a babe as well.
All right. Scores, please. That's the end of round two.
Oh, my God. Things have changed. Okay. I am in last place with 28. Sarah D. Bunting has 29. Sarah Baker has 29. Oh, sorry. My math is bad. Sarah Baker has 29. Sarah Bunting has 24.
Okay. All right. So what is our standings? Just in order, please.
Sarah D. Bunting is in last place. I'm in second. Sarah Baker's in.
Nicely done.
First All place.
Right. Round three is just stocking. One show.
Okay.
The points are doubled again.
So oh, my
16,
God.
16, 12, 8, 4. The show is, keep in mind, 5 appearances or more.
Yep.
Saturday Night Live.
Oh, no. Oh,
so we're going to give you some time to think about it, and I'll edit out the massive pause as you all think about
what?
Who
oh,
was the most popular actor given those parameters
five
for Saturday Night Live.
Or more.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Tara Ariano has locked in her choice. Sarah Bunting has locked in her choice.
Oh, no. This is so hard.
All right, everybody's locked in. Nobody seems really happy with what's going
I'm
on
not.
Here.
No.
Unhappy. Opposite.
All right, let's start it off with Tara. Tara, who is your SNL choice?
This is going to sound insane, but I'm going to say it anyway. Emma Stone.
All right, Emma Stone. I'm going to reveal the answers after.
Okay.
Make it even more exciting than it is.
Oh, boy.
Ooh.
Sarah Baker, who is your choice?
This is also insane for different reasons because it goes against every rule we've established. Steve Martin?
Steve Martin? Okay. Sarah D. Bunting finishes off.
You know who's on the ceiling of a lot of bunks? The mayor of Hollywood, Mr. Tom Hanks.
All right.
Yeah.
Here we go. Going from bottom up. Your number four answer worth 4 points. Not bad for just guessing fourth. Is Robert De Niro.
No oh my God.
There.
Wow.
Ooh. Gross. For that show, he's terrible on that thing.
He is so bad.
He is so bad. Cue cards.
Like,
he's like
truly
in the cue cards.
One of the worst hosts ever.
Yep. But that's not how, that's not the
I
metric.
I understand, although, I mean, is he fuckable? I guess.
Your third is another Robert. Robert Downey Jr.
Okay, sure.
Oh.
He at least was a cast member.
Your second is Adam Sandler.
Okay.
Oh.
Maybe he's just up there because he's got a new movie or show every 3 days. And people are just like, what the hell is this?
Sure.
Oh, Adam Sandler's in it. Fine. And our number one answer, and it's worth 16 points, guys, Emma Stone.
Fuck off!
What?
All
so
right.
Smart.
So that is round three. And I think I know what just happened.
13, 14, 15, 16.
Let's get the scores.
Okay, Sarah D. Bunting had 24, Sarah Baker 29, and I had 44.
Okay.
Holy
you know what?
Shit.
Guys, I gotta pull it. I'm just gonna do it. We're gonna use the tiebreaker. It's gonna
Thank
be another
you,
round
things.
Three. No, we're not
shit.
Done yet. I'm doing a thing.
Okay, okay.
Uh-oh.
Tiebreaker is now round four.
Oh!
Scores are the same.
Okay. Ooh.
I have a whole list here. So whoever gets the highest guess. For the show Bob's Burgers, I have about 20 names.
Oh.
We'll get 16 points. Bob's Burgers.
Oh, shit.
Highest guess gets 16 points. Tara is locked in.
Oh, God. Oh,
I'm,
God.
This is tentative because I'm not sure this person was in 5 episodes, but I'm going to stick on it anyway.
I'm just going to get it. I don't want to make you feel bad, Sarah Baker. You're not on the list.
Are you kidding? That's not shocking.
And Tara, Sarah, you're also not on the list.
Fair. Chocolate fair.
Even though once we were at a table read.
We did eat some breakfast burritos at that table read.
I can't possibly win no matter what, so I'm tempted to just put Robert Guillaume.
All right, everybody is locked in. Let's go to Sarah Baker first. You were locked in. You know your answer.
No, I know.
You're locked in. What was your lock and answer? Don't think about it. Say it.
I'm saying it. H. John Benjamin.
All right. H. John Benjamin. I'm going to let you know that he is on the list.
Ooh.
Sarah Baker. I mean, Sarah Bunting.
Literally the only name I could pull. So, also H. John Benjamin.
All right. Well, either you're both going to get 16 points. But Tara, I think you're automatic. I don't know if they could beat you now because of that tie, but let's see how it shakes out.
No, Sarah Baker could.
Okay.
I thought Bill Hader.
15 points ahead.
Bill Hader.
Oh.
Bill Hader. Oh, it's over, guys. H. John Benjamin was in the middle of the pack at about 10th. Bill Hader was our number two.
Whoa.
Bill Hader is number two.
What?
Okay. Wow.
Here's All some right. names
Tara,
in it.
Tara, you mad genius.
Here's some names outside of the cast. We've got Damon Wayans Jr. near the bottom. Jack McBrayer, Jillian Bell.
Oh, Jillian, yeah, she's my bestie.
We've got Thomas Lennon, Tim Meadows, Kevin Kline, Gary Cole, Sarah Silverman, Keegan-Michael Key, Jordan Peele, number four, Jenny Slate, number three, Megan Mullally, Bill Hader, number one, Stephanie Beatrice.
Oh sure.
One.
Well, that's great.
All right, so let's get the final scores. Tara okay. wins by more, I guess.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, so much more.
Still on 24 for Sarah D. Bunting, still 29 for Sarah Baker, and I finished with a gentleman 60.
Jeez!
Okay, well.
Tara.
That game is super fun, though. Great job,
yeah,
Miles.
Yeah, that was really fun. Do that again.
Here's why that's a great, great game for me. It combines needing to know things about pop culture and television. Also, what I enjoy is the tyranny of the masses aspect of it.
Yes.
Yes.
It's like that IMDb top four game that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or top also, three game that Joe and I made.
I think I overcounted myself because he was number two, but yes. Sorry.
All right. That is it for this episode of Extra Hot Great. We said I do to the reimagining of Mr. and Mrs. Smith before going around the dial with stops at Clone High, The Floor, Fargo, and Law and Order SVU. Sarah told us why she is not a crackpot. Julie successfully delivered MASH's Adam's Ribs to the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Miles. Next up is Curb's final season on Friday's Extra Extra Hot Great. And come back next week here for Tracker. Who knows what Tracker's about? We'll find out next week together. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
I have barbecue deficiency.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Nail clippings inserted.
And Sarah Baker.
You kiss like dogs.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Green.
We want something else! We want something else! We want something else!
All right, you can start.
Really keeps going.